This is a download from the Post-Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Good evening and welcome to the Keynes Seminar. For those of you who don't know me, which is very few now, my name is Mark Hayes. I'm the Fellow in Economics here at Robinson. And tonight it's a great pleasure for me to introduce two speakers, Dr. Stephen Kinsella, who will present his paper on Ireland's austerity policy, I should say, and Mr. Neil Lancastle, who has kindly agreed to respond. Stephen Kinsella, I hope I've got this right, is a senior lecturer in economics at the University of Limerick. He holds two PhDs, one from the National University of Ireland and the other from the New School in New York. He researches and publishes on a very wide variety of topics with a primary focus on macroeconomic policy in the spirit of Wynne Godley, I would say, and is actively engaged in public debate in Ireland and everywhere. I'm very grateful that you found time, Stephen, in your very packed schedule to come over from Limerick to speak to us today. Neil is a Cambridge graduate in SPS, Social and Political Sciences, and currently a research student at the University of Leicester. Like myself, he's taken the long road into academe, having returned to study after a 20-year career in, working on the back office systems of some major financial institutions. He holds an MBA, and his research interests include currency markets, stock flow consistent economics, and financial regulation. So Neil has kindly agreed to respond to Stephen's paper and to lead our discussion. Thank you. So without further ado, I will turn this round. Point it at Stephen. No pressure.
That's the signal, is it? Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming. It's a cold night. And I don't know if there's an elasticity of temperature with respect to seminar attendance, but it's certainly in my case a factor. But so what I want to talk to you about today is the sort of the cumulative research that I've been doing over the last maybe 18 months on producing a stock flow consistent model, an estimated stock flow consistent model of the Irish economy. So there are many challenges involved in doing something like this. It's not just the case that we're snapping a new model onto a very well accepted set of data. It's not the case that we're just feeding new data into an old model. Quite the opposite. We're having to produce a brand new database, which is quite large in scope. We're having to produce new computer code to actually run these models. We're having to really, really innovate in terms of how the systems actually cohere. And we're trying to do it with respect to a tradition, which comes from here, which is why I'm very happy to be here, actually. So this notion of stock flow consistent modeling essentially comes from people like Francis Cripps and Wynne Godley. And so it's really, really nice to be here, actually. And I never actually met Wynne. I spoke to him on the phone. I came to stock flow modeling through the need to teach something. We were talking about there's a big hopefully there's going to be a revolution in how we teach economics. And when I came back from America, from the New School, the head of the department said, "Hi, how's it going, son? Nice to meet you." And I said, "Look, I've just had a small child. Is there any chance you could give me less teaching for the first semester just to get me into it?" And he said, "No problem." And he gave me the highest teaching load in the department. And he gave me a master's module called International Monetary Economics, which was to be taught to people with absolutely no background in economics at all. So no pressure. And I thought, right, okay, so I can pull out sort of Obstfeld and Rogoff and wreck their heads with equations. But I didn't want to. So I emailed my PhD advisor, a guy called Vela Velupalai, who's also from this parish, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And he said, no, you must, this is 2007. He said, you must read Godley and Lavoie. I said, okay. He said, what they're doing, you'd be able to just show the students the data, make some graphs, produce a few little linear models, you'll be grand. I said, fine. So I got the book and I taught from it, and that's how I came to this stuff. I came to it through the need to teach something sensible about international monetary economics, and not through a need to model anything or get anything published in journals or anything like that at all. It really comes just from a need to teach something sensible. And so, and I've been doing it ever since. So when the newspapers rang me up and said, "What have you been teaching throughout the crisis?" I was quite happy to say, "Well, look, I've been teaching this weird fat blue book." So that's good. And then eventually I got a grant to build one for Ireland. Not really knowing what I was doing. It's really interesting when you write research grants. You write the grant as if you know what the answer is that you're going to produce. And they know that you don't know what the answer is. And so you play a kind of a funny, there's a weird little iterated game going on there. But anyway, I said, I know exactly how to build a stock flow consistent model. And they said, sure you do, son. Off you go. And that's how we started. Okay, so this first things first, because I know they're going to listen to this podcast, because I know I listen to it. This is funded by a grant from the Institute for New Economic Thinking. Thank you very much, guys, there. There's a team of people now working with me in UL, Antoine Godden, Wei Wu, Hamid Raza, Makis Minotos, and Ala Kayani. They've been amazing at putting this stuff together with me and for me. There's about 10 people now in Limerick working on this stuff, which I don't know, but I suspect maybe the largest group of stock flow modelers on planet Earth. I'm not sure. We'll see. Okay, so what happened to Ireland? So this graph shows you a couple of things. It's all indexed back to quarter, the first quarter 2007. And what you're looking at is levels, but indexed. Okay, so the red line here is GDP, and the blue line is debt to GDP. Okay, and the green line is unemployment. Macroeconomically speaking, if one were forecasting up to this point, okay, if you were forecasting up to this point, looking at the real economy, effectively your model has the same predictive power as a marble rolling off a table. So not my phrase, Lance Taylor in his book Maynard's Revenge uses it when he discusses CGE models. And effectively, so unemployment was more or less zero. You know, there was a 3-4% unemployment rate. Famously, there was a construction boom. There were guys coming in covered in plaster with their name on a van, you know, to collect the dough. Like, it was pretty crazy stuff. GDP was rising, had been rising more or less constantly for 14 or 15 years. Our debt to GDP ratio was 24%, the lowest or one of the lowest in the Eurozone. And suddenly it all went wrong, right? It all went wrong. And what happened to Ireland? Well, what happened was all of the things that had been going well stopped. And they stopped more or less instantly. They stopped in the month of August 2007 and stopped with the subprime crisis and the credit crunch that followed. The moment that happened, the interbank lending market dried up, and as it dried up, the banks that had been totally overextended because of their lending into the property sector suddenly realized that their business model was broken. Hedge funds, realizing that the banks were dependent almost entirely on wholesale funding, started shorting Irish banks. The collapse, this is all happening in a couple of weeks, around 2007. The collapse in the bank's share prices suddenly woke everybody up to the possibility that there was something wrong. The government moved actually quite quickly. It increased its deposit insurance from 30,000 to 100,000 euros, which had absolutely no effect on the outflow of deposits. At their height, just before September 2008, each of the individual banks was losing €1 billion in deposits a day from the system. The economy was bleeding money, deposits were leaving, our bond yields were curiously unaffected. So if you're a rational expectations person, it's an interesting question for you, why these bond yields were unaffected. And the government was scrambling around. What people didn't realize was the economy
had actually died about a year before that. All of the loans from the banks had been given out to largely insolvent developers. None of the property was shifting. It wasn't moving around. Because it wasn't moving around, the developers couldn't pay the banks back. But the banks couldn't stop giving the developers money, because if they stopped the construction of new stuff, everyone realized the Ponzi scheme had stopped. So rather than stop in 2006, 2007, call in these guys loans and declare a problem, they kept going. They kept hoping that somebody else would be the person holding the parcel when the music stopped. And as it turned out, everyone was holding the parcel. Because towards the end of 2008, once the government realized that there was nothing it could do under severe pressure from the European Central Bank, the government decided to guarantee the assets and liabilities of the Irish banking system. Ireland's GDP is 160 billion a year. The assets and liabilities of the banking system, conservatively at that time, were valued at 440 billion. So the day that you said, we guarantee this, you're insolvent. As a state that can't print your own money, the game is now over. Immediately the risk moves from the banks to the sovereign. Bond yields begin to increase almost linearly up. Everybody starts equating us with Greece. And then suddenly you have this wonderful montage on YouTube where you have people saying, Ireland is not Greece. Ireland is not Iceland. Greece is not Ireland. Spain is not Portugal. Portugal is not Spain. All these finance ministers coming out again and again and again. Really, really stressful kind of experience. But meanwhile, the price of property, domestic property, is falling. Banks are in real trouble. Everybody realizes there's going to be a problem. And unemployment begins to explode. Now, the reason unemployment is beginning to explode is because at its height, one in four Irish males was involved directly in construction. There was now no more construction. The lads started getting let go. And as they started getting let go, they did one of two things. They took the natural Irish route, the natural Irish solution to the natural Irish worker solution to business cycle downturns is emigration. They just hit the road. Normally they come here to build things for you guys, which is good. But in this case, you guys were in a lot of trouble too. So they went to Canada and Australia instead. So, but not everyone could do that. Why? Because for the first time in several generations, the lower skilled workforce could afford mortgages. They were in as much trouble as everybody else. All of a sudden, they couldn't move. The mortgage structure in Ireland is much the same as it is here. It's a non-recourse mortgage. They couldn't throw the keys back at the banks and leave. Big problem. What do you do? Nothing. You sit there and hope things get better. Well, unfortunately, things got a lot worse. The government had to borrow substantially to not only meet its commitments with respect to the banking system. That's now cost us 64 billion euros. Remember, the GDP of the country's 160 billion. So in fiscal terms, it's the equivalent of the US government turning off the Department of Defense. That's how much austerity has been done after 2011. After 2010. Because in 2010, we're no longer able to access the markets. GDP is still falling further, and unemployment has peaked, but we can't get any funding. The government has 5.5 months of funding left to go. They enter an EU and IMF program, and the IMF, as you all know, stands for It's Mostly Fiscal. So they went, right, cut government expenditure, increase taxes, stop doing silly things, you silly, silly men. Problem is, it's closing the gate. The horse, not only has the horse bolted, the horse has actually been disintegrated and turned into glue. It's a disaster, right? And so it's from this bubble that the government is now trying to manage a deflation. There are several features of the Irish economy I want to point out before I get into the model. And one of them is its incredible openness. It's open to an extent that very few other countries are. It's open to an extent that is sometimes illegal, you know, because it has some of the properties of a tax haven, which I often get myself into trouble for saying, but it just happens to be, it happens that the data bear it out. Sorry. So it's in this situation. What happened to Ireland was an old-fashioned construction bubble. It was an asset bubble gone wrong. Nothing, and I mean nothing, about this time was different. We all thought it was, of course. Everyone always does, okay? I'm currently getting in trouble because I wrote something for the newspaper today saying Bitcoin is a bubble. If any of you know what Bitcoin is, it's an electronically generated currency. And I said it's a bubble, and people are going nuts. And my point in the newspaper today was, of course it's a bubble. It went up 2,500% in a year. You are Irish. Do you not know what a bubble looks like? Oh, no, don't be silly. Don't talk it down. Don't talk the bubble down. And the exactly the same kind of logic. So it's a very open economy, which is one of the reasons why... I love this quote. Michael Lewis in his book Boomerang, but it actually came from this. He said he did a tour of Europe's disaster areas like Iceland and Greece and Ireland. He said, while Icelandic males use foreign money to conquer foreign places, trophy countries in Britain, chunks of Scandinavia, the Irish male used foreign money to conquer Ireland. Left alone in a dark room with a pile of money, the Irish decided what they really wanted to do was to buy Ireland from one another. That's exactly what happened, basically. That's exactly what happened. It's a little bit derogatory, but it's true. That is almost exactly what happened. And now we're in the cold, clammy embrace of the EU and the IMF for another... Today's the 19th. Yeah. So for another 24 days, Ireland is going to leave. It's going to exit the EU-IMF bailout on December the 6th, on December the 15th. But of course, our woes won't end there. So... is austerity's safety valve the trade balance? Now, I'm going to define austerity as a managed deflation of the economy through the wage channel. Okay, so this has distributional consequences for pretty much everybody, unless you're in the top maybe 5% of the wealth, the wealth distribution. For those guys, we created something called the National Asset Management Agency, which warehoused all the private developer money and created sort of a bad bank for those guys. They got a managed exit from the bubble. Everybody else is going to start going through a rather painful bankruptcy process. And there are tens of thousands of families who can't afford their mortgages at the moment for obvious reasons related to unemployment. So what we have here, it's just quite simple. It's a chart of the trade balance, okay? So you can see here exports, you know, they take a hit with the global economy and then they continue to improve. You should know that 50% of Ireland's exports come from pharmaceuticals. We produce all of the developed world's Viagra, which is quite nice for us and everybody else. You think we get it at a discount, but no. Yeah. And so 50% of our exports are pharma, but we are the world's largest exporter of software stuff. We spend a huge amount of our time building things like semiconductors. It's not just a haven for hot money. We really do export lots of actual things as well. And we would export something on the order of 100% of our GDP by value every year. So you can see, so exports are more or less exogenous to the Irish economy, more or less, because we're a multinational FDI giant, actually. Lots of foreign direct investment, lots and lots of manufacturing. Imports are obviously not exogenous, right? They're endogenous to the system, and you can see what happens. So they're trending up, more or less, but then you have this huge dip that never really recovers, because, of course, there's been a massive collapse in effective demand. Yeah? So demand has collapsed, and it never really recovers. Yeah, it never really recovers. So what do you see? You see the trade balance suddenly trending upwards. Yeah? The trade surplus. Trending upwards. All of a sudden, you combine that with a change in the euro, and suddenly we have a huge competitiveness gain. You're thinking, whoa, you know, none of this was government policy, right? But of course, they can claim that our unit labor costs have fallen by 27%. It's absolutely true. But you can see here that one of the reasons that austerity, in a sense, is working. Is because it's not that it's depressing individual consumption levels. It's because imports are actually falling, and it's the openness of the economy that's allowing it to absorb this huge austerity shock. So what that means is if they try to do this in Spain, yeah, that's those two lines are going to move together, effectively. And if those two lines move together, it means that the domestic economy, as opposed to its sort of rest of world part, is going to be much, much, much more damaged in Spain if it goes into a bailout or anywhere else. I had a piece last year asking whether Ireland was the role model for austerity, and I said no, actually it's not. But I wasn't aware of this at the time. In this respect, it is. In this respect, it is. If you're going to do austerity anywhere, you really want to do it in a small open economy with very weak unions, where prices and like wages are less sticky than other places, where the population is relatively pliant, where there's a socially there's quite weak social institutions. You really want to do austerity there. If it's going to work there, if it's going to work anywhere, it'll work there. Okay. I argued that it hadn't, and it wasn't. I still don't think it does, by the way. But this is a mitigating factor to my argument, because this allows us to absorb a lot of the austerity and just basically pass it off to the rest of the world. I'm a big fan of sectoral balances, with Godley obviously the progenitor of the idea. These are the sectoral balances for Ireland quarterly from 2013 to Q1. The red line there is public. So we it's the case that if you like, the private plus the public equals the world,
yeah,
or vice versa. So this is the green line here is essentially the government deficit. Okay, it's all centered on zero. So you can see the economy running a pretty healthy negative amount, and then suddenly it goes positive because it's borrowing. But look now, it's gone back to zero. Ireland achieved a primary balance, positive primary balance, very slight, but a positive primary balance in the first quarter of 2013. Happy days. Austerity has worked, lads. We're in good shape. Well, yeah, except what has happened, because this is a numerical sum, of course there's no causality here, this is just accounting. But it's not that easy to make these charts, but anyway, you can see what has happened clearly is that the rest of the world has saved us, if you like.
Yeah.
So this has been artificially depressed by austerity policies. They simply decreased G and increased T. That's gone down. This has shot up. Our current account was negative for quite some time and then shot up positive. But look here, private sector deleveraging has been the result. Now that's not, again, not too surprising, because we have one of the highest debt levels in the world. The average household disposable income as a ratio of their debt is 206%. Just to give you a sense of scale, in America it's about 100. I think in the UK it's 120. So we're one of the most indebted countries on planet Earth. So it's not surprising that in that situation, up here it's about 220%, now it's about 206. It's not surprising that people try to pay off some of their debt, right? And also the savings rate has exploded. It used to be 1.6% a couple of years ago. Now it's 16%, you know. And the Minister for Finance is taxing savings in order to get people to spend more. What's really interesting is the demographic composition of the country has changed entirely. You have people in their 20s who can't get any debt at all. They love a car or an apartment, whatever. The banks won't touch them. They used to be, when I was a kid, the average banker in Ireland was this hatchet-faced bastard. You weren't an applicant for a loan. You were a supplicant, you know. You kind of crawled in and sort of did this for a while. And if your name was right and you had the correct accent, then you got the loan. It's actually kind of true, to be honest. I'm only being slightly facetious. Then that changed, and the banks actually had lending targets. They had amounts that they had to lend out. When I came back from the States in 2006, I was everyone was like, buy a get a mortgage, get a house. And I was looking at things going, this doesn't make any sense. You know, it's a bit crazy. Like, I just come from New York, living in the East Village, you know, 20 restaurants on every street. Rent was $2,000 a month. There were two couples living there. It was expensive, but it was good. And then I went to Limerick, which is not the East Village. And people were talking about rent for 1,500 euros a month. I thought, this is nuts. Anyway, I went there, and that was fine. Went to the bank, and I said, I would like to get a mortgage, please. And the lady said, the bank manager is not here. She'll be back later. I said, no problem. There's my card. I'll come back, whatever. I'm just looking. About a half hour later, I was back in my office, and I got a knock on the door. Who was it? The bank manager. She'd come to my office to give me a mortgage. It's crazy stuff. So things went a bit mental around about here. And you could see without doing any econometrics, without doing anything else, something has clearly changed in the Irish economy. From this period, where things are kind of trending downwards, it's pretty stable, but then everything more or less shifts here. There is a structural break in these systems from this point. But what you can see, to answer your question, I think, what you can see is if the austerity policies that they have to pursue for the next 2 years at least, because we're part of something called a macroeconomic imbalance procedure, as well as still fulfilling our commitments to the Troika, mean that line's going to go like that. So if you forecast for 2 years, that's got to come down like this. Now, it might level off as the political business cycle takes over and the politicians realise, oh Jesus, we need to get re-elected. So that'll probably level off. But it also means this is going to get pulled lower. Yeah? Because we don't have much control over the rest of the world, which implies our current account will go higher into surplus. Yeah? So if your current account is in surplus but your private sector is deleveraging and your government is reducing its expenditure, are you going to be in a recession? Almost certainly. Yeah? At the very, very least, you can expect that effective demand will be kind of constant, if not trending slightly downwards, for at least the next 2 to 3 years. And that's without doing any kind of causal modelling or anything else. So, okay, I really like this quote. It's from a guy who actually works from INET now, a guy called Marshall Auerbach. Deficit spending by the government is the counterpart of private sector saving. What government deficit spending does is to permit the private sector to achieve its desired level of saving. When the latter changes, government spending ought to be adjusting in the opposite direction to offset it, unless the current account happens to do the job. Well, so what's happening here is both is happening, right? The government is really hammering in its expenditure down at all costs. Taxes are going up, but the private sector is just allowing the rest of the world to take up the slack because the private sector has no money. Most of the guys who were really big during the boom are now, if they walk into a bank without even talking to anybody, alarms start going off, right? It's the same with the rest of the country. So just so much debt. It means that the rest of the world really has to take up a huge amount of slack. And it's able to, and this is a really important point, it's able to because of the openness of the economy. Yeah, it's a really important point that should be brought out. Okay. So the authorities got it very, very, very wrong. This is Ireland's Department of Finance writing in 2007. The economic and fiscal outlook over the period is as follows. GDP is forecast to expand at 3.5% per annum. Right? That should be GNP there. There's a distinction in Ireland between gross domestic product and gross national product because we are a multinational hub. Net factor income from abroad subtracts about 30 billion out of our 160 billion euro GDP. Anyway, the average annual increase in employment is 11.5%, with unemployment assumed to average about 5.5%. Just to give you a sense of what actually happened, the unemployment rate went from 5.5% to 15%. The GDP went from, in growth rate terms, went from minus 1 to minus 13. And our debt, as I said before, went from 24% debt to GDP to 121% over this period. So they got it really, really, really wrong. They computed a mean squared error of the forecast. You said it'd be 2.5, but it actually turned out to be 2.6. So your mean squared error is 0.1 squared, yeah. And they computed it for several 5-year periods, one of which was obviously this, and. So the mean squared error is around 3 for every other period apart from 2005 to 2010 when it's 128. They got it wrong. very, very wrong. Why? Why did they get it wrong? Right. Number one, they didn't recognize the models now, not the authorities. The authorities didn't recognize it because for them, the idea of the growing Celtic Tiger economy was what psychologist and psychoanalyst David Tuckett calls a fantastical object. You know, something that you desire, that you bend reality to obtain. A bit like Bitcoin are now, actually. First, they didn't recognize the importance of capital flows and intersectoral flows in particular. There was no attention paid to the necessary adjustment processes we need to have within a fiscal union. Effectively, Ireland borrows in a foreign currency. It has no power to affect interest rates, no power to affect anything. Because it borrows in a different currency, it therefore needs to pay very strict attention to its fiscal policy. What were the lads doing? Giving away stuff to get elected so they could re-energise the bubble. The policy-making system in Ireland made things worse, not better. And it went exactly at the moment that one would expect regulation to kick in and slow things down, it was actually weakened by the policy-making process. It is certainly true that models built using representative agent structures have no feeling for banking or default issues. Everything is modeled as a friction. You obviously can't default on yourself. There's only one of you, you know. Well, maybe you can, I'm not sure. But it's certainly the case that models, the large models that have been and are being used by the Department of Finance and the Central Bank, do not have default built into the system. It's just impossible. Yeah. Except as an information shock, which this obviously wasn't to most of the population. So this is a new model based on Godley's and Lavoie's work, building sectoral models from balance sheet data. It also has a lot of work to do with other people. So, okay, there's enormous issues around data quality, calibration, and estimation I want to talk about. But I want to get on with it. So I'm going to skip this because I presume a lot of people here are kind of familiar with stock flow modelling. So basically, you've got stocks and flows. And you add them up in a balance sheet matrix. You connect them with a transactions matrix. And then you build a model on top of it. Okay? There's adding up constraints. They're large models. So they're sectoral level. You don't have agents in them. They're just, households, things like this. You have dynamic behaviour via past behaviours, past periods. I could ordinarily in the linear models get a steady state solution, and they've got generally post-Keynesian features. Not everything a post-Keynesian might want to see. I understand that, but there's enough there that you can call it a post-Keynesian model. Now you've got to calibrate these things. Godley and Lavoie at the end of their book say, "Wouldn't it be lovely if somebody calibrated this stuff?" That's because I'm sure they had a go at it, and it's very hard. it's very, very hard. There's been a couple of attempts to do it. OLS estimation, which I'm going to show you, vector error correction models, which is the Levy model in the US, and a model for Greece. Reis and Jacques Mézier have a VAR-VEC-M model, which is quite complex, and I'm going to show you the results of a VAR-SVAR, structural variation. There have been very limited attempts at empirical calibration so far. I'm fairly sure, I'm reasonably sure this is the only one, and this is why. Our strategy is data calibration, do an OLS, and have a look at a VAR. The data come from the flow of funds and market sources. And essentially, we need to be careful here. We have Ireland's treatment of non-financial corporates, big firms like Microsoft, need to be taken care of. That's because Microsoft remit a massive amount of their profits from the US to Ireland. If you sell Microsoft Office in America and it costs you €100, they remit those profits to Microsoft Ireland. Microsoft Ireland then report those and blow up that number. So we need to be very careful when we're looking at this. It turns out there's an easy way to do it, but it took us a year to find the easy way, actually. So what you're looking at here are the non-financial corporates treated for that effect. So we've got quarterly data from 2002, pretty small sample. The data is pretty noisy. And you've got to remember, this is a small open economy experiencing a heart attack halfway through the data, right? So we're not looking at sort of, long-run logged trend data or whatever. This is an economy that goes like that and then goes like that, yeah? So there's a tent in the data. Therefore, generalizing these findings is difficult. So I'm sorry about the size of this, but it's here. So here's our model. We've got non-financial corporates, which you can think of as everything from Microsoft to Stephen's secondhand bookshop, right? Financial corporates, so that's banks, private banks, but also the Irish Central Bank. We chose to treat it as a private bank because it doesn't have a monetary function effectively. The government here, households, and the rest of the world by the current account balance. Okay, so what we have here are the flows. Current account balance, consumption, taxes, disposable income, prices that they pay. GDP is here. Investment, net exports, consumption, taxes, and various prices as well. There are different instruments in these models. These are coming straight, by the way, from the flow of funds, deposits, equities, loans, and securities. And what we're looking at when we're looking at this model is, obviously there's a real sector as well, but it's very standard. Y is equal to C plus I plus G plus X minus M. What we want to look at here is how these things interplay with the real sector. That's why these models are valuable. All right. So we want to do a calibration first to see what the data look like. If you're building a big model like this with large amounts of coefficients, lot of variables, lot of parameters, you pretty much never want to show it to the data right away, ever, because you don't know how the model reacts. You want to generate some rubbish data on a spreadsheet that you know how it's going to behave, and then expose that to the model. Or another way you could do, we did that first actually, by the way, another way is to do this empirical calibration. The stuff that Godley and Lavoie did in 2006 is a pure calibration. They just come up with a number, shove it into the model, and see what happens to the line afterwards, right? That's completely fine. And we do that too. And I have many papers where we do that. If you do that, then you have to find this stock flow norm, this idea that debt to GDP has a sort of a norm over time, and hang the model off that in some sense. Now, parameter discovery, when you want to do an empirical calculation, is no joke. Because, the model goes like this. The data go like that. So you'll have alpha being 0.5 here and then minus 0.5 here. You have to allow these things to be time-varying. If you allow them to be time-varying, well, then you need to constrain the model some other way. We constrain it using Godley and Lavoie's initial insight, which is that, everything has to go somewhere. So if everything has to go somewhere, we constrain it via the edges of the matrix in that sense. So the model structure is built, but it's under very strong constraints to fit empirical norms. But if that's your constraint, then where you choose to constrain the model really depends, it really defines how the model is going to react. So, for example, if you choose quarter one of 2007, the empirical calibration results look very different than quarter one 2002, for example, right? Because where you choose to sort of take off from, depends. It's an initial condition problem. So the choice of reference period is very important. We picked the peak of the bubble in order to be as reflective to the past as to the future. Okay, so I'm going to show you a table in a second. Here's how to read it. It shows the table here shows the effects of changes in taxes on spending on important variables relative to a steady state value. Sorry, quarter four 2007. So what we want to do is we want to impose more austerity. The ECB actually wanted more austerity after the 2010 disaster. So what we're going to do is we're going to say the Minister for Finance wakes up one morning and goes, Jesus, we're all fecked. Run around. Stop spending now, right? We're going to run all of the austerity that they ran, but from the fourth quarter 2007, right? We're going to drop government expenditure by about 14% and see what happens. So what you're going to look at here are the changes in disposable income as a percentage of GDP. So it's this formula. So it's the income in a particular period, which will be 13 quarters, 14 quarters forward, or so forth, two quarters, minus the reference divided by the GDP and the changes in taxes. We're just going to look at the real economy. And each statistic that you're going to see in the next chart is a percentage. So, for example, a T plus 2 with a small spending shock, the change in disposable income declines by 0.73 relative to a steady state. So that's the long-run norm I was talking about. Okay? So here's what we have. Here's what we do. We shock everything. In the base case, disposable income drops by nearly 1%. But if you do less austerity, then of course the shock is less to you. Okay. If I punch you in the face least hard, you won't be as bruised, I suppose. And you can see that the shock deepens; it gets worse over time. And you can see what happens. We shock the spending and the tax rate. You can see that with more austerity, things get worse. But look, after a certain period, if this is a sort of 3% shock to overall consumption, which via the multiplier effect in an economy at the zero lower bound, you know, basically means that nearly a 5% shock to overall aggregate demand. So, and that's just the impact on income. Of course, if you drop my income, you drop my ability to pay taxes, then you drop here. And that's where you end up doing. So what we've actually come up with, there are other statistics that I report in the paper, but just to get on with it, what we show really clearly is that if you want to do this kind of fiscal consolidation, what you should actually do is work on taxes, not government expenditure. So Alessina talks about the history of fiscal consolidations and how much you should cut, and he says all the empirical evidence of the stuff that I want to look at, not the actual stuff, drops government expenditure. You should drop government expenditure by 2/3 and increase taxes by 1/3. That's what your composition of your adjustment should be. What we're saying here is, if you believe this version of the Irish economy, we're saying it should have been the exact opposite. You should have increased taxes by 2/3, especially on capital. Certain types of capital, and you should have decreased government expenditure much more slowly. That would have gotten you there without the austerity. Yeah, without as much of the austerity. Got to remember, at the peak of the boom, the Irish economy was maybe 120% in terms of its wealth of the OECD average. It was always going to have to come back down. It's just how you manage that. That's I guess the point. Okay. So were there policy alternatives to... That's grand. So what? That's my PhD advisor. I always do come and go, you never guess. I've proven it all. And he goes, that's grand. So what? So this is... I always put this slide in. It's true. So what? The point is, if you adjusted government spending, you would have been in a much better place now. We wouldn't have had the level of recession that we would have seen, and there wouldn't have been as much unemployment. People would not have been as damaged by it. There certainly were policy alternatives. So what I'm going to show you now is the estimated model. So we just do OLS, and what we do is we look at things like, I'm going to show you a couple of these pictures. The red line is the fitted value, and the black line is the real value. So this is employment. You can just see what happened. I mean, it just bubble collapse. You know, that, like, there are very few economies that have that picture when it comes to employment. But the point is, this model, employment relative to GDP, the real wage, time and the nominal wage, sorry. Oh, yeah, no, the real wage. They're all very highly significant. It's a pretty good model because we're taking account of different factors. Household disposable income, same thing. Again, you can see what happened to household disposable income. It went straight up, flattened out, and now it's just flat. Yeah? It's just flat straight out. Okay? And what's happening here is that this tax effect is happening. Nominal wages have fallen by quite a bit, but this is the big factor. Okay, so you can either reduce people's wages or reduce taxes. And what this is telling you is you probably should look at that. Financial corporate loans. Again, all the charts with respect to Ireland are kind of disaster, you know, scary stuff. Again, what you can see is financial corporate loans are generally related to the level of securities, government loans, and this is government securities issue. But you can see that over the time, these loans are actually always negative and always falling. Okay, and now they've plateaued out. So what's happened to the Irish economy? It's kind of flatlined. It's kind of a secular stagnation going on over this period. I report more regressions in the paper, but I kind of prefer the figures. Duncan Foley used to say, I haven't been convinced by a regression since about 1983. And I like regressions. I think they're cool. But you've got to, I mean, especially if you're doing OLS with a stock flow consistent model, got to be careful. And financial corporate holdings, again, there's that big outflow that I talked about earlier on. That's them just running out of the Irish economy as quickly as they could. Okay. And it's kind of stabilized now that we've got our credit rating back. Cool. So this is the first version of an estimated model. But it's not where we want to stop. Further work. Any stock flow consistent model can be written, I've thought about this for a long time, can be written as what's called a structural vector autoregression. It's kind of using the tools of the enemy at one point, but it's very good. Essentially, What it does is it restricts this matrix here, this B thing. You restrict it in a certain way. And because you restrict it in a certain way, how are you going to restrict it? You're going to restrict it with respect to stocks and flows. You're going to make sure these things balance. Why you want to do an SVAR as opposed to an OLS or anything else is because the vector autoregression will actually take account of all the interactions. That's really important. They'll take account of all the interactions. And suddenly you'll be able to see how these things move, and you'll be able to be sure that your estimated model is stock flow consistent. That's something nobody's been able to do yet. The problem with doing this is that these are computationally intensive. We ran the Irish stock flow model is an 80 equation model. We ran this stuff through a supercomputer for the last week. We have a computer mapping the basin of Ireland for oil companies to explore better. And I asked the lads, because I play football with them, I said, can I have time on your supercomputer? And they were like, no. I said, please. So they gave me some. And so they ran this thing. These are not trivial things to do. And you're only, I think I had two lags or something. These are lag values. This is your actual value, okay? They ran the thing, and they ran it. It would take a laptop like this 3 months to run one of these. That's how big these are. This took 2 hours, but this is designed to crunch terabytes of data, right? And they ran it, and I was really excited. They ran it from 3 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock in the morning on this Saturday. And it came back, and I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? And I was really looking forward to tell you the first results. It came back with error. So I said this to a colleague. I said, I'm going to Cambridge to give a talk. And he said, what happened? I came back with an error. He said, when I did my PhD, a computer was a room. And you went into the room with bits of paper with punch holes. You put it in, you know, and then eventually the punch holes, if you got it wrong, the thing wouldn't compute. So he said, we're right back where we started. So I think I'll stop there, but that's what I'm doing next. Hopefully if I can write the code properly for it. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Stephen. That was very entertaining. As always. So I've got about, 20 minutes?
Yes.
So I only got this paper 24 hours ago.
Less.
Probably. So I'm doing a kind of general general reply on Ireland rather than a specific on the paper. So the question being, are there policy alternatives to Ireland's austerity? I'll give you an outline of the paper as I understood it. I'm going to stress this problem that Stephen has picked up, which is that the data are very problematic. And then I'm just going to talk through some of the questions I have around the actual SSE model. And then I'm going to present some data that pretty much tells the same story, actually. But I'm just going to roll us back to something much simpler, which is, what is this approach?
So I've got a quote here.
I think I got this through the post-Keynesian study group, actually. A letter from Wynne Godley to Galbraith, which said, in this personal correspondence, which we had access to, the only point I would wish to make is that, as you will quickly realise, the thing meaning this approach, is to a very large extent an exercise in accountancy. So I'm just going to stress that. This is basically about the accounts, the national accounts. As I understood Stephen's paper, he has a five sector model, and the central bank is part of the financial sector. And one of the things I wondered is whether, in fact, the way you've described it is actually the IMF, whether there needs to be another separate modelling of that, or a modelling of that as part of government. Okay. I'll explain why as I come through. And in the consumption function, households are consuming out of disposable income, current and past. And that's something else I wanted to pick up on and question. And again, as I understood it, the rest of the world is demanding deposits, loans and equities, and supplying bonds. But actually, as I understand it from the data, you do get the rest of the world also supplying loans and supplying deposits. So I'm just questioning particularly how that's modelled. I agree absolutely that there is this very distinct, these two very distinct regimes. So you said, I think, pre-2007, I think actually it's the end of
end of Q4 2007.
Yeah, it's basically beginning of 2008, yeah, thereabouts. And you estimate your model using OLS. So this, as I understand it, this is one of the first, you know, one of the first papers I've picked up that's gone into that level of estimation. You do a couple of shocks to taxes and spending, and in your future work you're looking at an SBAR. So that's the paper I'm looking at. In your paper you do some of the accounting. This is a bit small, but what I wanted to show here is that the very simple accounting has your private sector surplus, so households and firms, is equal to deficit spending plus your current account surplus. And I'm just going to unravel that, which is what you did. But I want to stress here, this is a net position. So this is the net position between the domestic and foreign sector. And actually, I think the gross positions, yeah, before you've netted, are actually quite significant, because this is an open economy, because there's a lot of financial activity, and because there's people trading. They're looking for higher yield, they're looking for lower risk. So I think the net position is relevant. And I agree with you absolutely. I mean, I've just listed some of the category issues and data problems. So, you know, your flows are denominated. To tell me how long I've got. Your flows are. There are currency issues throughout. So your flows are converted on the flow date. Your stocks are converted on the balance date. So you're missing a lot of financial intermediation in this data around currency. And also some issues around, you don't see things like the duration. So you don't see the fact that your lending is, your interbank lending is funding some of the longer term household lending. You picked up on the problem with Irish subsidiaries. You picked up on the problem with transfer payments. I think they call it a double Irish.
Now it's called a double Irish. Double Dutch, double Irish.
It's a Dutch sandwich.
Dutch sandwich, yes.
So this wonderful tax arrangement where the American company sets up an Irish subsidiary, which in your model appears in the non-fight. You said you've adjusted for it, yes. So we need to tell me how you've done that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot, basically there's tax avoidance going on here. There's profit being accumulated in Ireland, generally, because of the lower corporation taxes. So as I put it here, there's a lot of booking of revenue offshore, where Ireland is often offshore. So that's going to affect the model significantly. And just to give you a picture of that, some of the gross flows, this is the rest of the world. You see this very sharp break, as you do, between pre-2008 and post-2008, particularly this massive outflow of deposits, despite the guarantee. Mm. The rest of the world is getting rid of currency and deposits in Ireland as quickly as it possibly can. So there's some very significant gross flows which don't necessarily show up when you just look at the net figure, because there's a change in the composition of these flows. And presenting that in a, as you did, in that kind of, what does this look like in the stock flow consistent way, leading up to the crisis, the foreign sector is always saving. But pre 2008, most of this foreign saving is as deposits and as equity. Whereas post 2008, there's a change in behaviour, and the deposits are moving out, and actually the foreign sector is lending. Which again, I would possibly. I mean, I haven't looked at it, but it sounds to me like this kind of double Irish tax. You know, you make a loan and then you get the return on equity. The household sector, as you said, is dissaving, it's borrowing from abroad until post-crisis. It completely changes its behaviour, starts to pay down debt. The current account is fairly healthy leading in. Current account is negative.
Yeah.
And then turns positive. And the government actually, prior to this, is generally running a surplus. Mm, and then goes into a very sharp deficit. So So there's this implied, in that accounting framework, private saving. Mm. But I say implied because when you look at the details, I'll come back to that. Most of this actually is not, this is mostly the intervention. This is the intervention, of this is public intervention. So this is your 64 billion, I think you said.
Well, yeah, that purple one. At the very
this implied private saving is actually your IMF loan and your intervention from the bank bailouts. Mm-hmm. So it's by far the most significant thing in all of this is the bank bailout, which is exactly what you say. It's a significant banking crisis. But what you don't mention in your paper, and I think you should, is that Ireland is constrained because it's part of the EU. So this is, if you look at, think of this as a cross, and at the foot of the cross is the government deficit. The Maastricht rule prevents you from going down. It prevents you from running a significant deficit, this 3% rule. It's asymmetric, which Wynne might not like, the idea that you can run whatever kind of surplus you want, but your deficit can only be 3%. So you're constrained here, and if you follow Ireland round, it runs from this top left quadrant where the government is in surplus and the current account is in deficit, small deficit, and it runs right down to very rapidly into this government deficit position. Then it starts to come back out again in the last couple of years to a position where it's almost meeting the criteria for Maastricht. But then you add to that the EU scorecard, you're hemmed in from both sides. So you have to have a current account deficit between -4% and +6%. So in fact, Ireland only meets these criteria for 2 years, three years, 2005 to 2007, just about meeting the criteria, but it spends a very long time travelling around them, trying to get back into some kind of safety zone. If you then add to the fact that it's quite useful for households, for the private sector to be saving, at least your household sector to be saving, you may be even more restricted in the space that you can be in. So this red and green is private sector running a deficit, private sector running a surplus. So you're very restricted because of the Maastricht rule, because of what's happening in, what do they call it, the alert mechanism report, the scorecard. So in terms of a trajectory, it's quite hard to see whether you'll actually hit that point. Will you overshoot, which is what you suggested, and go into a very significant current account surplus? Will the lack of government, the government running a deficit, actually force the private sector again into this red zone, so into private sector running a private sector being in deficit? Critics of this would say you need to split this. You need to split this into household saving, which is generally probably quite good, the pensions, but also you need to think about investment, real investment in plant, machinery, production. So it's a very simple way of looking at it, but on this model it does look, as you've said, that you're going to overshoot. So the criticism or the point really on the model, this is from Taylor actually, but when you talk about the spending function, you don't really refer to what's happening to household wealth. So households aren't spending, sometimes spending capital gains, sometimes spending realised or unrealised capital. You referred to Minsky. But I just wondered if you need to bring into your balance sheet some discussion of their assumed or their imagined wealth from property prices. And also, I think you started to do this, but this real problem with understanding the balance sheet for the financial activity that's going on. So what Taylor does is he separates out shadow banks. So shadow banks, they take out loans from real banks, they buy real financial assets, they take profit. There's a profit extraction here or capture. by shadow banks or both from the financial assets and the government bonds. And I think that's probably the biggest problem, is how do you untangle this financial activity, which is accumulating profit and taking it out of real spending. So I'm just wondering if, I mean, since you have a team of 10, it might be possible to do that in more detail.
Sure.
So I agree with you absolutely that with the story about bank leverage, there's between 2005 and 2008, basically banks doubled their assets. There's a huge, huge amount of financial leverage, particularly Merrill Lynch, which is another story which I wondered if maybe needed to be picked out. So you talk in your paper about this being a problem with household borrowing, but you didn't say where. So did you mean in Ireland, or actually there's also this contagion, isn't there, from the US? Merrill Lynch, I think the day after Lehman went bust, Merrill Lynch was bailed out by the Bank of America, by the Bank of America, and the US government made good on its credit default swaps with AIG. If it hadn't, would this be a very, very different story. So I just wondered some of the history, unpicking some of that. So what this graph just shows you is as the banks have deleveraged, they've actually become much less their costs have started to exceed their income. It started with Merrill, but there seems to be some contagion, or it seems to be catching other banks. So by the time you get to 2012, this is just the top seven. We've got Merrill, Bank of Ireland, Allied Irish, IBRC are all running costs higher than income. So that's not a particularly positive picture. If that's where you are today, well, this is up to the last set of accounts, so 6 months ago. And you're about to come out of the IMF loan. So in summary, I think it's a very interesting paper. I really like the use of the method that you've used to get an estimate, really, for the model. But as always with these, I mean, this is the problem with these models. You can always disaggregate the sectors further. You could be looking at not just separating out the central bank or the IMF, but also what's happening on the derivative book, what's happening with central banks. What are some of these effects in terms of balance sheet, effects in terms of the currency composition of the assets, particularly with foreign banks operating in Ireland. So my main criticism really is around this wealth effect. Was there a wealth effect? People were spending these realised gains that they're then not spending because the property is falling in value. Could you dig more into some of this profit retention, whether you look at shadow banking or how you model that financial activity? I think we've talked about this, whether SVAR is an appropriate method for correlated shocks. I think we're not sure yet, but I just wonder if taking that method further into, if you know that these shocks are all at the same time, 2008, possibly due to this contagion from Merrill, you know, from what's happening in the US, is they're really, you know, they're highly correlated. But in terms of some comments on the policy alternatives, you know, what about changing the scorecard? What about changing Maastricht to be symmetrical? So Germany can't run more than a 3% government surplus. What about having a stronger EU that can spend more than 1% of it of the total budget? You know, if you could take Cameron out away with his veto, if you get him out of the equation, could you get some proper spending and fiscal redistribution? And most of all, I think what impact, because you're relying on this constant capital inflow from the foreign sector, what impact will any reform of EU tax have? So if there's a harmonisation of things like corporate taxes, will you actually see a reversal of some of those flows, and what impact might that have? So basically, I think look at behaviour more.
Yeah.
And you've got a team of 10. Why not? So just some general comments. So thank you. I love the paper,
cool,
as always.
Thank you very much indeed, Neil.